Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and you are listening to the MCRIT podcast. So today, for a number of reasons, we're going to discuss a concept called delayed sequence intubation, DSI. And I figured it would be fun to start with a case. So you have a 50-year-old guy, bad bilateral pneumonia, BP 108 over 70, he's a little tacky at 102, he's breathing 30 times a minute. The guy is delirious and agitated, and he looks sick. He needs to be intubated because his saturation is 70% on a nasal cannula. So you try to pre-oxygenate the guy, you stick a non-rebreather on his face and he just rips it off, and you put it back and he rips it off. The question is, what are you going to do now? Now, traditionally, what you would do is you would get ready for intubation, push your RSI meds, and then make one of two choices. Either you would precipitously intubate him, and if you did so, you would be doing it without full paralysis on board. You'd be waiting till he was just sleepy enough that you could get the laryngoscope in there, and maybe he's still moving around a little. And even if he isn't, he doesn't have full muscle relaxation, and you're really limiting your first pass success. Or, if you're a little more patient, you'd probably bag the guy during his apneic period. And then you're putting the patient at risk for gastric insufflation and possible passive regurgitation. But you'd have to accept those risks because you can't leave the guy at a saturation of 70%, because then, essentially, as soon as you stuck your blade in his mouth, you're already on that plummeting portion of your oxyhemoglobin desaturation curve, and he's gonna go into potentially injurious levels of oxygen saturation, and that's when the patients start getting bradycardic or coating on you during the intubation. So your choices pretty much were bag or flail with a precipitous intubation attempt. I don't like the odds on either of those, so I came up with a concept called DSI, delayed sequence intubation. In a nutshell, what DSI is procedural sedation, with the procedure being pre-oxygenation. The way the sequencing goes is you push a medication, and for the purposes of this beginning discussion, that agent is ketamine, because that's what DSI was developed with. That's the agent that works best for this. So you're going to give ketamine. You push ketamine 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram. Whatever dose it takes to disassociate the patient. Usually on a normal, hemodynamically stable patient, I'm going to give 2 milligrams per kilogram. If they're a little sick, I might start with the 1 milligram per kilogram, see if they disassociate. If not, then I'll give 0.5 milligram per kilogram aliquots until they're disassociated. Ketamine takes about 30 seconds to have its onset. So you're going to see very quickly these patients go from flailing around and encephalopathic from their sepsis or their disease state or their hypercapnia or their hypoxia to a nice disassociated ketamine-type patient, at which point they are breathing, they are maintaining their airway reflexes, but they are no longer ripping your oxygen mask off. Now, let's pretend that oxygen mask was enough to get their saturation up greater than 95%. What you do at that point is you'd let them breathe through the non-rebreather for another 3 minutes. This is going to denitrogenate the patient. It's going to give you that buffer of safe apnea time. Now, while that's happening, you have all your intubation gear ready. You have your suction ready. You have your BVM ready. So if there was any adverse event during this pre-oxygenation period, you would push your paralytic and intubate them, and just as you would if you forgot about this DSI entirely. So really, if they had laryngospasm, if they're not taking big enough breaths, if you're not happy for any reason, then just go back to the RSI, push your paralytic and intubate them. I don't see those things happening in the DSIs I've done. Generally what happens is I push my ketamine. They breathe through the non-rebreather. I wait 3 minutes. I push my paralytic at that point. I wait another 45 seconds for succinylcholine or 60 seconds for ocuronium. And then I intubate the patient. And now I'm intubating with a saturation in the high 90s or 100%, and I have a bunch of time before the patient desaturates. I didn't have to give a single positive pressure breath. I didn't have to risk gastric insufflation. DSI allowed me to pre-oxygenate the patient. That's all it is. DSI is procedural sedation for pre-oxygenation using an agent that has no effects on respiratory drive and no loss of airway reflexes. Now, that's the simplest form of DSI. It's DSI where all the patient needed was to leave their non-rebreather mask on. Now, is there any literature to support that? No. There's no literature yet published prospectively looking at DSI. But the components of it have been studied extensively. Can ketamine be used for procedural sedation? Absolutely. And in fact, in this month's Annals of Emergency Medicine, the most comprehensive guideline for the use of ketamine for procedural sedation for both children and adults was just published. And I will put that in the show notes. Incredible article by Steve Green, Burak Kraus. You got to read it. And what you'll see from that is all of the literature showing ketamine keeps airway reflexes. Ketamine allows the patient not to have any decrease in their respiratory drive. Ketamine is an incredibly safe agent. It's used extensively throughout the world for anesthesia, for operations, without any airway maintenance whatsoever. So based on that, I think there's enough data to say you could give some ketamine and stick the patient on a non-rebreather mask. Now, one of the questions that comes up is, isn't ketamine going to make the patient vomit? Now, from my experience and from the articles included in that guideline, ketamine does not make patients vomit during the sedation. If it makes patients vomit at all, and there is a risk between 5 and 15%, it's during emergence. Well, we're never going to let this patient emerge from their ketamine until after an endotracheal tube is in between their vocal cords. So I don't worry about vomiting. If you guys just decided to prove me wrong and get ketamine and cause the patient to vomit, I still think if there is any incidence of that as a side effect, it is dramatically lower than the chances of the patient regurgitating from having to get BVM ventilation. Because DSI is not a comparison to doing nothing to the patient. As we discussed at the outset of this, DSI is an alternative to having to bag a patient. So let's just recap what we discussed so far. DSI, you break in the sequence of rapid sequence intubation. Instead of giving simultaneous sedative and paralytic, waiting 45 to 60 seconds and then intubating, what you're doing is you're giving ketamine, you're sticking the non-rebreather on to let the patient pre-oxygenate for 3 minutes. After that's done and the patient's saturating well, only then do you push your paralytic. You wait another 45 to 60 seconds and then you intubate. DSI. Now, there's been some talk amongst various people about DSI being something different, that DSI would be any sedative agent. And it can't be. It has to be something like ketamine. And we'll discuss some alternatives in just a bit. But it can't be etomidate. It can't be propofol. That's not DSI. Somehow, there's been some conflation with DSI and patients with ARDS. Nothing to do with that. I know where that came from. I'm going to discuss that next. But that is not what DSI is about. DSI is simply procedural sedation for pre-oxygenation. Now, what happens if you do put that non-rebreather on the patient after they got their ketamine and their sat's not coming up? Well, now you have a scenario where the patient is exhibiting shunt physiology. And what I would do in that circumstance is I would switch from the non-rebreather mask to a non-invasive mask and put the patient on between 5 and 15 of PEEP. And really, 5 is almost always what you need, not the 15, but whatever you need to get their saturation greater than 95%. Because pretty much the only reason the patient's going to be continuing to stay desaturated on a high FiO2, 65 to 75% on a non-rebreather, is because of shunt physiology. If they're breathing and that non-rebreather's on their face and they're still not saturating well, they have shunt and they need CPAP or PEEP in order to get their saturation up. So in those patients, I would be giving the ketamine 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram. I'd be putting on the non-invasive mask and letting them breathe for 3 minutes on the non-invasive. This does bring up another question, and it's a fair one. The question is, can you take a patient who is quote-unquote altered and use non-invasive? That's always been a classic contraindication to non-invasive ventilation, is a patient with poor mental status. You have to understand where that contraindication comes from. You don't want to stick a patient on a bed on the floor with non-invasive on their face when they're altered, because they're going to vomit. It's going to blow the vomit down their airway, and no one's going to figure it out until a half hour later when a nurse checks up on the patient. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about you standing at the bedside with all the equipment you need ready for intubation while the patient's on non-invasive for a period of 3 minutes. Very, very different. The patient's not going to puke because ketamine's not going to cause emesis. The settings I discussed for CPAP will not open the esophageal sphincter. They're not going to be insufflating air. And if they did, you're right there. You're ready to intubate. You're ready to suction. But that's not going to happen with any greater probability than you taking that same patient and blowing positive pressure into their stomach when you bag them, which is the alternative in this circumstance. So ketamine DSI can be used with non-invasive. But again, there's no prospective data for this. This is just my practice. And I will publish a case series on this, and hopefully we'll publish a prospective trial as well. But for now, this is all based on extrapolation of ketamine for procedural sedation for all sorts of other things. All right, so that's the basic idea of DSI. Ketamine, either a non-rebreather mask or non-invasive mask, pre-oxygenate, paralyze, intubate. Let's look at some variants. What do you do with a 75-year-old with a history of coronary artery disease? Maybe they're a little tacky to begin with. You can give ketamine to those patients, but it feels a little bit risky. Those are the only patients I don't like to give ketamine to, are these ones who are old with coronary artery disease. So what else could you use to do DSI? Well, I have used an agent called dexmedetomidine. It is an alpha-2 agonist. It gives essentially the same disassociated state, but instead of raising the heart rate and blood pressure slightly, it lowers it. Nice medication. Only problem is it goes in by infusion over 10 minutes, so it's not as quick as the ketamine. It'll work. Now, another agent I've used for this, though it's kind of annoying in the United States, is droperidol. And droperidol will give you kind of, I guess it's still a disassociated state, and the patients will still maintain their airway, and they'll still keep breathing, but they just won't fight you so much. And droperidol works for this, and the dose is between 5 and 10 milligrams. Problem is, the black box warning makes you a little leery of using it. And if you did do this with droperidol, I'd certainly advise getting an EKG afterwards and making sure the patient's QT has not been prolonged. The other problem with droperidol, in distinction to the dexmedetomidine ketamine, is that these patients really still have awareness, even though they can't fight you. So if you did a droperidol DSI, I would advise a sedative at the same time you push the paralytic. So the sequence would be droperidol 5 to 10 milligrams, slap on your oxygen mask or your non-invasive, wait 3 minutes, and then push etomidate or propofol or whatever sedative you like in addition to your paralytic at that 3-minute mark. Some other variants. I had a GI bleeder the other day, needed to be intubated, was going to get endoscopy, had a bulging belly, which I was sure was full of coffee ground emesis. Now, I like to get an NG tube in these folks first before I intubate them, but this guy was having none of it. So we did DSI, pushed my ketamine, put the oxygen mask on the guy, dropped an NG tube, sucked out his entire 1,400 cc's of blood that was just a time bomb ticking in his belly, waited 3 minutes, pushed my paralytic, and I intubated him. And now, at least I feel, that was a much safer intubation than having the stomach just waiting to explode filled with blood. All right, one last thing. And now this is really pushing it. I feel very confident in this, but this is my practice that I'm going to tell you about right now. It's not something I necessarily recommend for you, though I don't see any reason you can't do it. But please, I think DSI is pretty solid. This next bit, you really have to be good at the components in order to make work. But oftentimes, I will have done DSI because I had a patient that looked horrible. They were flailing around. They couldn't get any air in. Maybe they were a bad asthmatic or COPD-er or APE patient. And I pushed my ketamine, put them on the non-invasive, and oh gosh, they just look so peaceful. They look so happy. They're saturating 100%. Their vital signs have come back to normal because their epi and norepi have diminished because they're relaxed now. And they're breathing at 14 times a minute. And oh, they just look so good. And while I had that succinylcholine in my hand, I don't push it. I wait. I watch. I have an ED critical care unit. I have the ability to just sit there and look at my patients. They're surrounding me. I'm not going anywhere. I'm there. I'm watching. And I just leave them on that non-invasive in their little ketamine hole. Eventually, they wake up. Most of the time, they wake up and they're normal people again. We fix their hypoxia. They're back to themselves. They ask me, "Could I have a glass of water? My mouth's really dry." I avoid any intubation on those patients. Sometimes they wake up and they're still crazy. Obviously, it wasn't their hypoxia that was making them encephalopathic. At that point, my patient's pre-oxygenated, like mad. I'll push my sedative and paralytic and I'll intubate the patient. Now that's really pushing the DSI concept, and that's gonna get me flack. So please, again, that's not DSI. That's something different. That's really pushing the concept. That's true non-invasive with a patient who's disassociated. Not for 2 or 3 minutes, but for a while until that ketamine wears off. So I'm just telling you I'm doing that, but please don't take that as an indication that I'm recommending this as standard care in an ED. But DSI in its pure form, I think, is ready. And on that note, if you have done DSI and it's either worked or not worked for you, please drop me an email. I want to know about those patients. And if the IRB will accept it, I want to publish on not just my patients, but yours as well. So please throw me a line. Let me know if DSI has worked for you or if it hasn't. Now, Ron Walls on his Airway site has written about DSI. And he's a little skeptical, and I understand why, but a lot of the reasons were not really the way I'm describing DSI. So I'm going to send him this podcast, and hopefully Dr. Walls will come on and we could talk to him about that and many other things in the airway world, because he's kind of an airway hero of mine. All right, so we're running out of time here. Before I go, I want to tell you about a fantastic book I was sent to evaluate. It's called The Toxicology Handbook. It's in its second edition, and it's by Lindsay Murray and some other authors, and one of those other authors that's particularly dear to my heart is Mike Cadogan from Down Under. Mike has been a friend to MCRIT and has really taken MCRIT a long way in understanding how to get the message out to more viewers, and they've really done a fantastic job here. They've basically compiled all the information you need at the bedside for managing a tox patient, and they put it in basically a pocket-sized book, I guess, if you're wearing a lab coat. Now, I'm going to give this copy away. There'll be a little link on the upper right of the show note page that's at mcrit.org. Come on over to the blog page and click on the link to win a copy of The Toxicology Handbook by Lindsay Murray, Mike Cadogan, and we'll be giving one of these away by the next episode. So check that out. Also, if you don't know, there's a lot of discussion on the Facebook page, facebook.com/mcrit, that is not necessarily going to be on the blog site. So you should definitely go over there and like the page. Make the page one of your favorites, and that way all that discussion will be put in your Facebook page as well, so you could actually see the discussion that's going on. And based on one of those discussions, I'm actually going to do a short video post on how to take rings off your bad trauma patients as their fingers are swelling up around those rings. All right, so I'm going to stop there. As always, send me your comments, send me your emails, go to the blog page, mcrit.org, to see the show notes. And if you haven't, you should subscribe to the email notifications of the show notes, and that way they're sent right to your email box, as opposed to having to keep checking in on the page. So I have a link to that as well in both the show notes and on the upper right of the page. All right, Scott Weingart for the MCRT podcast, and I will talk to you soon.